Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Kara.
And this is Missy.
Hi, Miss.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. We were just talking, like, we're maybe had a little taste of spring this week.
Yeah. A little nice. Climate change. It's a little too early.
Yeah, I know, right? I just read a book about climate change yesterday, and now that you said that, I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe the 75 degrees in February is probably no good.
Yeah. But I started reading a book yesterday that you had recommended to me.
Which one?
By The Women by Chris Avena. I'm only 5 chapters in, and I'm hooked already. So
okay, so for those of you who know me, I am a huge bookworm. I have big, lofty goals to read a lot of books this year. And Kristen Hanna is one of my favorite authors. She wrote The Nightingale, The Great Alone, Four Winds. There's so many good books, right? Her newest book, The Women, if you're a nurse, and most of you who are listening to our podcast are nurses, the plot centers around nurses who served in Vietnam, and it is riveting. She actually, if you listen to the audiobook, she talks about all of the research and all of the women that she interviewed as research for the book. And I just can't, like, I could not stop. I read it so fast and was so angry and like disappointed, and not with the characters, because I loved them, but just with like how society behaved towards Vietnam vets in general and then towards the women.
Well, everyone that knows me knows how much I love podcasts, and particularly true crime or political things. And I literally have probably 20 that I listen to as soon as the episodes come out. Like, I'm always listening to new episodes. I'm thinking they're going to be put on the shelf for a bit, and it's going to be all about this book until it's done.
Worth it. So if you don't have it, or it's not on your to-be-read list, put it on your to-be-read. Honestly, the actual book, the audio book, it's all amazing. Especially if that's like, I love historical fiction. And so it's right in my sweet spot of genres, but also I'm a nurse. I also came from I have a military family. There's a lot of things for me that brought up, and I loved it. Yay. I'm so glad you're reading it.
Yeah. I love it.
All right. Today's topic. I have a lot of strong feelings about today's topic, and in the context of our conversation, those will come out, I'm sure. So today we're going to talk about the ARRIVE trial and what that looks like in the inpatient setting in terms of outcomes, in terms of just what we have stirred up in the obstetrical community. And I have some very bullet pointed things that I'm going to say about it, but Kara has done the research, and she is going to give us first the overview of the trial and what it was and who was in it and why did we do the ARRIVE trial? And then I'm going to interject some commentary.
I think we'll both have some commentary, but I think the really cool thing about this is we've been talking about ARRIVE now for 5+ years. So, it was published in 2018, and let's get into it. Okay. What? So the ARRIVE study was a randomized trial of induction versus expectant management. Mm-hmm. That's where the words ARRIVE came from. And it was really looking to see if elective induction of labor during the 39th week of pregnancy would result in a lower rate of death and complications for babies, rather than or compared to waiting until at least 40 weeks and 5 days. For elective induction. So delivery during the 39th week or waiting until 40 and 5 or after. And the ultimate goal was looking at outcomes for infants. And they wanted to also, as a secondary, to see if inductions had any effect on the risk for C-section birth. So the study took place at 41 hospitals across the US. That's a lot of hospitals. And they screened more than 50,000 people to see if they could take part in the study. And they found 22,533 that were eligible for the study. That's a huge sample size of people that were eligible for the study. But only 27% of those people, or 6,106, agreed to participate. So that's a pretty low participation rate for a really large sample size. It ended up with 3,062 being assigned to induction at 39 weeks and 3,044 being assigned to expectant management. And expectant management, again, was that you waited for spontaneous labor up until 40 and 5, or you could be induced for medical reasons before that, or be induced electively at 40 and 5. So, you know, in research studies, we assign people to groups, but then if something changes, like a planned home birth, if it was a planned home birth study, but they go on to deliver in the hospital, it still counts as a home birth outcome, if that makes sense. They were assigned to the home birth group. Okay, what did they find? Well, really, they didn't find any difference in the primary outcome for babies. So delivery at 39 weeks did not improve the primary outcome of death or serious complications for babies. But for mothers, induction at 39 weeks was linked to a lower rate of cesarean compared to those that were assigned to expectant management. And it was a cesarean rate of 22% in expectant and 19% in those that were induced at 39 weeks. So 22% to 19, both of those seem quite low compared to the overall C-section rate across the board. And we can talk about that a bit. And then people had a lower chance of developing hypertensive problems of pregnancy, like gestational hypertension or preeclampsia. That makes sense because a lot of our hypertensive disorders present the longer the pregnancy goes on. And so if you had shorter pregnancies, you would have lower rates of hypertensive disorders. One of the other outcomes that was kind of down the road was that mothers that were in the early induction group spent more time in the hospital in labor. So their labor time in the hospital was longer, but they had less time in the hospital postpartum. And again, that would make sense. If the C-section rate was lower, it would make sense that those people wouldn't have as long of a hospital stay postpartum. So those are the outcomes.
Okay, so I want to take a step back because this study was 2017, 2018, 2019, that time frame.
Published in 2018, yeah.
I want to take a step way back. So in when we first became midwives in the early 2000s, we didn't have a lot of rules about elective induction, what was super safe, when we could do things. This has really been a phenomenon of the last 20 years, right? It is so what I'm getting at is in 2010, the March of Dimes, based on some like healthy babies, right? The, you know, healthy people goals, put out a safe birth initiative, which means we shouldn't be electively inducing anybody before 39 weeks. It was called the 39-week toolkit. And if you've heard that, it's old now, right? It's almost 15 years old. It was published in 2010. And the intent was there are reasons we should induce people before 39 weeks, but we should eliminate all elective inductions prior to 39 and zero.
Yes.
So that laid a groundwork for something like the ARRIVE trial.
Right.
Right. So we kind of like now in hindsight, we should have seen it coming, right? That somebody was going to be like, okay, well, yay for the 39-week toolkit, which I actually really appreciated at the time because it gave me something by which to base decisions on where we didn't really have a guideline before that.
Yeah. I mean, I think midwives always were more in favor of waiting, but you're right. It was all of a sudden all these hospitals started implementing 39-week rules. And I mean, like you had to provide pretty strong rationale for why someone was going to be delivered before 39 weeks once that toolkit really rolled out and people started to adopt it.
Yes. Also, now there is an absolute, like a pretty tried and true established list of when you should induce people who have obstetrical complications. As a matter of fact, at Vandy, we have it hanging like in our box where our providers sit, and you can, it's in alphabetical order, and you can be like, okay, Cholestasis of pregnancy. Let's look it up. What is the actual evidence-based time frame for induction, right? Pre-E without severe features, right? Oligohydramnios, absent end diastolic flow, right? When you go through all of the complications, we know now when, based on neonatal outcomes and maternal complications, when we should induce people. So it used to be we had to give a lot of strong evidence about why we wanted to induce somebody before 39 weeks. We have a lot of evidence now that tells us when we should and exactly what the time frame should look like, right?
Yes.
Because sometimes I'll be like, I'll work triage and I'll be like, I have this patient who's gestational hypertension. And so we'll go through and we'll be like, okay, does she actually meet gestational hypertension criteria and can she be induced today? Or how many days does she need to wait, right?
Yeah.
So I think we have been building on this body of literature for some time, but the impetus really was, here's the foundation, 39-week toolkit, right? Which very much did decrease elective cesareans or elective inductions, excuse me, by a lot, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, if you look at the statistics nationwide, I mean, it is a sharp and rapid decline when this started to get implemented, right? It came out in 2010. I would say by 2012, 13, like lots of hospitals had 39-week initiatives. We weren't doing anything elective before 39 weeks. Fantastic. Then 8 years after this 39-week toolkit comes out, we get the ARRIVE trial results, right? My first talking point is never in the history of the world have we changed our universal practice in medicine based on the results of one study.
Yeah.
Never in the history of the world.
Well, and you know, the other thing is that we talk all the time in academia about from research results and then one study or even in multiple studies to implementation is somewhere between 7 and 15 years generally. So not only not in the history of ever have we based it on one study, but also, whoa, that was fast because it was immediate.
I also would like to highlight another study that I feel like we changed our practice on quickly in obstetrics. And I'm like, seriously, now it's happened twice. Was the term prom study. Like everybody like adopted all this stuff about term prom, how, right? And that was one study that had an N of 5,000. And
well,
then we find out not even a year ago that it wasn't really super valid. Like the statistics were wrong.
There was an error in one table that like drastically changed management.
Everything. Okay. So OB community, let's do better. This is two examples, right? So my first thing is why did we drastically change practice? Not just in one part of the country, but like across the country as a standard in obstetrical care. We're like, oh, yep, this one study. Let's just like, we're going to jump right on this.
Yes, agreed.
And I feel strongly about that because I have a DNP. So my brain thinks in terms of quality improvement. I think in terms of improved patient outcomes, decreased cost, improved satisfaction, right? And improved provider satisfaction. That's how my brain just functions. And yeah. I have been a part of a lot of QI initiatives in a lot of hospitals across my almost 20-year career. And I will give you a key example. We didn't have a Foley bulb for ripening protocol at one of my hospitals. And I cannot tell you the amount of literature I had to pull out and write about for my hospital to even consider like getting a protocol for a Cook catheter. I'm like,
yeah,
come on, man. Like, we've been using Foley bulbs forever, right? There's so much about cervical ripening and it's like a body of literature you have to present. So the whole idea in my QI brain that we were like, oh, yep, we're just going to blanket this change across all OB practices is just mind blowing. So I'm going to leave that there. I also think there are a lot of people who agree with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you brought up the idea of quality improvement because it also makes me think about there's so many other questions that I'd like to look at now, because we said that it lowered the C-section rate, but postpartum, you know, labor stays were longer, that sort of thing. So I think automatically to like, what did this do to hospital organizations? What did it do to nursing staffing? If people are in labor longer and taking up labor beds kind of idea. We've both been at really huge academic centers where there is a shortage of beds always on the labor floor.
Always talking about beds. We are always talking about, I am actually getting ready to embark on another QI journey because of bed cost. How yes. long people are sitting in beds. So that goes right back into this arrive trial thing too.
Yeah. So just to throw out the nerdy bit here, when we talk about QI, a lot of times we're talking about health outcomes. We're talking about satisfaction, all those things that Missy talked about. In my brain, we're also thinking about organizations and structure, process, and outcomes. And so what's going on in the organization based on that change. So great stuff to think about, but let's get into some of the nitty gritty of what this meant for practice.
I will tell you that here we are 5 years post-arrive. And you cannot find an elective induction spot for several weeks if you look at our SNAP board.
Yeah.
Because doctors are like, well, we can induce you at 39 weeks. And people are like, sign me up.
I feel like we used to talk about the 39-week rule as you can't do anything until 39 weeks. And now it feels like some colleagues in medicine, the 39-week rule means I have to get the baby out the 39th week. And so it became more of a, not is this able to do something at 39 weeks, but I have to deliver them at 39 weeks.
And I have worked with providers who feel like they are at risk in terms of liability if they don't induce somebody or get a baby out at 39 weeks. And I'm like, that is not how this works.
Right. Right.
I also say, a lot, especially with primips. Most first-time moms without intervention will go 6 days past their due date. On average, 6 days past their due date. That's 40 and six. That means average, half of them will go before that, but half of them will go longer than that. And what are we doing when we are saying, oh, 39 and one, come on in, sweetheart. Like, I would love to get your baby out. And I want to see a whole study on Bishop score at time of admission for elective 39-week inductions.
Yes. Yes.
Because I'm specifically talking about primips because this is the problem. How many primips have a favorable cervix at 39 weeks. Meaning for me, a Bishop score over 8. So if for students who are listening, go back and recall your Bishop score things, right? But for me to get over 8, you have to be about 3 centimeters. You have to be more than 50% effaced. You have to be soft and anterior, right? I don't care as much about station, right? Babies are going to come down, right? Right. But in terms of Bishop score, soft and anterior gets you a lot of points. And soft and anterior for me means ripe, or at least riper than, you know, firm and posterior. But so if they're not 3, it's funny because the other day I had a primip come in and she was 3 centimeters and soft and anterior, and I still gave her Cytotec because I was like, she's really thick. Like, yeah, she could still use some ripening, but I digress. My point is 39-week cervixes in prima gravidas are not ripe. They're not ripe.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the other things about the study that has been critiqued pretty widely, and I think rightfully so, is that the study did not describe what the protocol was for induction. So they didn't talk about Bishop score upon entry. They didn't talk about ripening or not. They didn't talk about the protocol for Pitocin. Was it, you know, a high dose protocol? Was it a low dose protocol? We're missing some of that detail. And I think that what you're talking about is highlighting that of like, well, we had a lot of women, I mean, 6,000, but we don't know what was done during their labors. it resulted in lower C-section rates than what we see nationwide. So what was it about this group that was different than, you know, the rest of the population? And so you've raised a really good point. I feel like there's so many inductions that end up spending a day or two doing ripening in the hospital.
Oh, Kara, I when people come in for induction and I'm working as like the Gen 1 person, my speech to every single induction is, I'm going to check your cervix and we're going to talk about Bishop score.
Yes.
I do my exam. I talk about Bishop score. And then generally I say, you are going to spend 24 hours doing ripening, which means every 4 or every 6 hours, we're going to give you medication. Nothing else is happening. If it's a nighttime induction, would you like Benadryl, Unisom, or melatonin to sleep? Because you need a nap. Right. If it's right. A morning induction, did you have breakfast? Right. Like, did you eat something? Because I'm going to start this induction and we're not going to let you do anything but clears. Right.
Right.
And then 24 hours likely of actual induction. So when people come in on a Thursday and I'm like, this is not, you're going to see your baby in 8 hours. This is going to be, you're going to see your baby on Saturday.
I do a similar talk and then I say, but if you're one of those lucky ones, I love to be surprised. I love to be proven wrong, you know, because right. occasionally right. there's one of those really amazing, fast ripening and delivery kind of things.
I had a patient come into triage the other day and I ended up inducing her, but I gave her that speech when I was in triage that I was like, it's going to be a long couple of days. I said, it was exactly a Thursday. And I said, you will see your baby Saturday. I was on Friday night into Saturday. She had her baby at like 8 o'clock Saturday morning. And she goes, you said it was going to be Saturday. And I was like, gosh, I wish I had a crystal ball. But the ARRIVE trial, we did not know enough. We did not know what all those women's Bishop scores were. Back to another very important episode that we did. We did not know what their BMI was.
Right.
Right. Because we know with increasing BMI that we have an increased risk of C-section. We also need way more ripening and induction agents. Like there's so much about the sample, right? And I just want to be clear because everybody wants to say like 6,000 women is a huge study. The reason they say it's a huge study is because it's oftentimes really difficult to recruit that many women. But I want to put it in context. 6,000 babies is what Vanderbilt, one hospital in one state, delivers in 1 year. So I am not up on the birth statistics, right, nationwide, but it's not that big of a study.
Right.
And it's also not that big of a study to not have enough information on.
Right.
Right.
Well, and you know, and as midwives, we talk a lot about the P's, right? I mean, there's whether you think there's 4 P's or 8 P's or however many P's you think there are, one of them that's important to midwives is psyche and your attitude going into birth, your attitudes about birth, your where your headspace is during and around the time of pregnancy and labor and birth is so important. So for those people, the out of the 20,000 that declined participation in the study, was it because they looked different than people that were like, oh yeah, please. I mean, like, I'm just happy to be induced before 41 and a half weeks. I want to be part of the study. Did that look different than the group that had a mindset around like, yeah, let's induce? Because we know that a lot of our patients that seek midwifery care really do want to wait for spontaneous labor. So did that population that they studied, did the sample look different than a population of people that includes those that really desire expectant management, if that makes sense? I'm not sure I'm describing it well, but I think the headspace and where people are probably had something to do whether or not they agreed for participation.
I also think it's 2 years ago, everybody was like, oh, ARRIVE trial, ARRIVE trial, ARRIVE trial. And I think now people are backing down from using the ARRIVE trial as a justification for like elective induction because of the faults.
Yeah. I mean, and there was, to be fair, a lot of discussion when the study originally came out I remember being part of a journal club with a group of OBGYN residents sitting around. I think we had barbecue that night and talked about the ARRIVE trial. And we did talk about some of these things at that time, but it certainly feels like people moved really quickly to changing practice based on one study.
I don't love it.
I don't either. Everybody should know that the American College of Nurse Midwives did put out a response to the ARRIVE trial, and you can still find it on the ACNM website. And it discussed some of the things that we're talking about today. But I think, you know, I love calling out our midwife friends that are rock stars. And there's a really great publication from January of last year, January 2023. From Sasha James Contarelli and Holly Powell Kennedy. They're kind of rock stars in the midwifery world. That was some reflections. It's a commentary, but it really points out a lot of these issues. And I love highlighting midwifery authors. So kudos, Sasha, and kudos, Holly, for good work, because you've done a nice job explaining what some of the concerns are.
Is there anything that they mentioned that we haven't talked about yet?
No, I mean, mostly that we don't know about the protocol. We don't know a lot about the population that chose to participate versus those that didn't. I think that's really some of their major things that they talk about. And they really highlight the idea of shared decision making, and not that the provider decides I'm going to deliver you at 39 weeks, but really making sure that your patients, it is a shared decision after a really informed consent. I think that might be part of what's missing in some practices nationwide.
Another talking point highlights, I should put these talking points in our show notes, but is if you look at the outcomes, you have to induce 28 people to prevent one C-section.
Yeah.
That means for every 100 people you induce, you have prevented 4 C-sections. I don't, and I might be able to be talked out of it, believe in that benefit. Because also, could those 4 people have gotten sectioned for a variety of reasons? Right. I also think that when we induce people who end up with a cesarean, we also have to sort of stratify why. And is it that they had a failed induction, right? An arrest disorder, right? Arrest of descent, arrest of dilation, arrest, right? Labor arrest.
Right.
Because people get sectioned for a whole lot more than just arrest. They get sectioned for non-reassuring fetal status. Maybe that had nothing to do with their induction, right? Right. They get statted for a cord prolapse, right? I mean, they get statted for bleeding, right? Some of those things, and really causation and correlation, right? You really can't like say that it didn't have to do with their induction, but there are some things that have nothing to do with induction, right? So when we think about preventing C-section and looking at causes of C-section in patients who are induced, I think there are so many factors that add up that you can't necessarily point it back to an induction. Like the reason you had a C-section is because you were induced. I don't think that's the case. I also, you were just talking about the P's, right? Pelvis, passenger, right? Did you have a big baby? Did you have was it not going to come out whether you induced them or not? Like there are so many factors in OB that I think it's difficult to point to induction as a causative reason for an outcome like a C-section.
Well, and you just reminded me of one of the important things that is discussed in the midwifery article that I just mentioned. And that is the people that were participating in the study, those providers knew that their patients were participating in a study that was looking at inductions and type of delivery outcomes. And so did their practices change? Were they willing to be more patient? Because they knew that this was, you know, we're trying to see if it increases the C-section rate or decreases the C-section rate. did they do their Pitocin protocol differently because they knew people were watching? That's hard, right?
Like the research, right? Flaw. And the flaw is the reason that we double blind protocols is so that people don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree. Like, did you change the things that you would have normally done? Because you know it matters.
Well, and I don't know your thoughts on this. You are currently working at an academic health center. You have worked in small community hospitals. I similarly have worked in community hospitals and the big academic center. And I know at the academic center where we always had people in-house, we always had anesthesia available. We were super patient. We were able to watch a lot of things, maybe a bit longer than someone might in a small community hospital, based on that we had resources around us all the time. There were always residents in-house. There were attendings in-house. And studies generally, these 41 hospitals, studies are generally done at academic health centers, which may look different than what's going on in a community where you're the solo provider for hundreds of miles around you. And does your practice look different than what is going on at the academic health center?
So many questions. You and I are also huge on this idea of informed consent in shared decision-making. And
yes,
I have had a lot of conversations in the office in that setting where people are like, well, maybe I want to be induced and maybe I don't. And I say, well, here's what this looks like for you at 39 weeks with a cervix that's 1 and 50 and not super ripe.
Yeah.
I said, I, you know, in a lot of cases, I would be like, I think giving it more time is not a wrong thing to do in the absence of complications. And the absence of there being a reason why we should or shouldn't do it. Now, I will also say, you know, my doctoral research was on why women were dissatisfied with induction of labor. I kept hearing moms come in postpartum and like, my induction was terrible. I hated it. I laid in bed for 2 days. I ended up with a C-section, whatever, right? And I was trying to put my finger on why. Why were women so like blatantly dissatisfied? And mm-hmm. It came down to the idea that the consent that they felt like they got did not include shared decision-making and did not mm-hmm. include all of the appropriate counseling. And so ultimately we ended up putting in like a smart phrase into our informed consent that we had talked about all the things with the patients. I also think it definitely has skewed now when I have people come in for induction, how I talk to them. It's going to be ripening. It's going to be induction. It's going to take some time. I don't want you to be disappointed if you don't see your baby in 12, 24, 36 hours. This is a process and I need you to know what you're getting yourself into. And that is very much my way of being like, you know, I know that birth can have huge impacts on depression, postpartum depression specifically, right? If you are dissatisfied with your birth or you have a traumatic birth or you have a, you know what I mean? Like a long induction where you end up, you know, with a C-section or a long induction. Mm-hmm. Where you have a vaginal delivery, but you've been in bed for 3 days trying to have a baby.
Right.
I worry then about postpartum depression. I also have a lot of questions about breastfeeding initiation and postpartum depression and how that all goes together, right? NICU admissions. So NICU admissions for me are another thing that are like pour right into postpartum depression kinds of things. And so like, I think all of that goes together. And if you don't set the right tone in terms of informed consent and shared decision-making at the time of induction, there mm-hmm. are all kinds of things that I think will affect the mom's psyche / you know, slow roll or fast roll, I guess, into postpartum depression, you know, in the first few months after delivery.
So I think you raised some really good points. I don't like the frame, let's play devil's advocate, but I want to say another side of the story is that when you do have a really informed patient and they make the choice that they would like delivery at 39 weeks or 40, before 40 and 5, it's nice that we do have some data available and that we can share that. I think I hear sometimes some midwives really being like, no, we have to wait for expectant, expectant. We want spontaneous labor. And I'm like, oh, of course we like spontaneous labor, but I also believe in choice and informed choice. And so I like that we have data. In full transparency, I also had an elective duction at 40 weeks and 0 days. I came in at 39 and 6 for ripening and delivered on 40 and 0. And I was that primip that was fingertip thick and posterior. But I was a midwife and I had a fully informed decision of what I was doing. And I felt really empowered during my birth. Thankfully, it wasn't a 3-day induction. I had a pretty rapid labor, actually. But all of that to say, when you do have someone that is fully informed, like you said, and they have the information going into it, even if they have an unanticipated outcome, they felt like they had some power in the decision making, and they felt like it was part of a shared decision, and that can be really powerful. So
we are also shitty at walking into rooms and being like, hey, can I break your water? Hey, can I put a Foley balloon in? Hey, we're going to start PIT. Rather than, and I hear my residents do it, and I hear other providers do it, and I am probably guilty in some of these scenarios as well, where we need to like think about like, here is what's happening in your labor course. Here's what I would like to happen. Here's how I would like to achieve that. Do you have questions?
Yeah, really thinking about risks, benefits, and alternatives for each intervention, and getting consent for those things. I agree. I'm a better midwife today than I was 15 years ago.
You know, I also walked around with a cook cath at home when I was like trying to get Brooks out. So, I mean, you go into it with eyes wide open, right? If you have, I felt like I had a lot of control. I knew what was happening. When it fell out, I had to make a decision. Do I go to the hospital? Do I stay home for a little while? Like, right? I mean, there are so many things about the context of this study that don't feel great as a midwife that I also think, like you were saying earlier, have very much skewed from we can't do anything before 39 weeks to I need to get babies out at 39 weeks. And that was not the intent of this study.
And let's remember that there was no change in the primary outcome, which was looking at death and serious injury illness for infants. And so that really was the ultimate goal, was to know that. And there was no change based on timing of delivery and induction at 39 weeks or 40 and 5.
Such like knowledge is power, man.
It is. The nerd in me, the academic in me is like, oh, this is such a good example to really get into the nuts and bolts of research design, sample size, sample characteristics, protocol. Could someone take your protocol and implement it, because there's enough detail there to know exactly what you did? Those are really good questions. And so all of you in school out there, be thinking about those types of things as you read journal articles, because we want to have a critical mind, but we're so thankful when there is evidence that can support things.
There's just so much information that we don't have that I want.
Yes, agreed.
Because we have talked a lot about ripening and obesity and those things, like Bishop score, even just Bishop score. Like, I just want to know everybody's Bishop score. At least what was the average Bishop score on admission? Maybe that would help.
That would help.
But if it was 8, let's just say the average was 8, that would tell you something.
God, I want to work wherever those people had an average Bishop score upon arrival of 8.
Right?
Never happened. Wouldn't that be awesome?
I mean, yeah.
You know, my dream practice, mole tips with a proven pelvis.
That's right. like my proven to 11-pound patient the other day.
Oh, that's amazing. No, that's right? Amazing. Well, Missy, I want to thank you for a really good conversation today. And I think we've raised some things that people can be thinking about, but also really highlighting how important shared decision-making is and informed consent.
And just knowing that there's a lot of, I think, commentary and conversation coming out now around the Arrive trial. I don't think we're taking it back.
No.
Mm-mm. I don't think it's going to be like, we're not going to talk about the Arrive trial anymore. I do think it is encouraging critical conversations that maybe may at least take a few, like a walk back a little bit of, this is not the end all be all of everything that we need to be doing and thinking about in terms of elective induction at 39 weeks. So yeah, been really good. Well, thanks for joining us for the Engaged Midwife podcast. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Take care.